Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are over there, along with all the other things that we are doing. Articles, videos, all the stuff. Go over to the YouTube channel. Subscribe to that if you haven't. There's content there that is only available on YouTube. And it's a good place to be subscribed to because literally every video we do, even if it appears in other places, it also makes its way over there. So if you're wondering, like, where's all those 1517 conference talks? Where's all those Chad Bird videos? Well, they're all over there in one place. So if you subscribe to that, you won't ever miss any of them. Chad, we ended last week with Samson meeting Delilah, falling in love with her, apparently. This is what the text says. And now things are going to take a little dark turn.
Yeah, like right away. It's almost I don't know if this is intended or not, but I can't help but see it. So this all happens in a place called the Valley of Sorek. And so you're like, you know, kind of last thing we heard about Samson, he's on this mountaintop, you know, in Hebron, and now he's down in a valley. Things are really going to get pretty low here. The Valley of Sorek is just like this wadi, like a what would we call them in Texas? A dry gulch or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, wadi only has water in it when it rains. It's going to have a low, dry creek bed type deal. Runs from the Judean Mountains all the way to the Mediterranean. And it was pretty close to where Samson's hometown was at, but that's where all this goes down. We're not sure. I don't think I brought this out last time. We're not sure about Delilah's nationality or whatever you'd say that fits with that culture back then. Probably a Philistine, though. I mean, she has a name that could be Hebrew. I mean, it kind of fits with the Semitic language, but I'm guessing she's a Philistine just because of her interaction with the Philistines. Anyway, the main point is that we know her name, and she now has a man who's head over heels in love with her. And the lords of the Philistines, not to miss an opportunity, decide they're going to take advantage of this situation and use her as they tried to use, as at least some Philistines tried to use his fiance to get to him. Except now what they want to know, there, I mean, it's obvious, you know, this was never any question that Samson has this just superhuman strength, but nobody knows why. I mean, how can he be this strong? I mean, even, you know, the guys that win the strongman competition, Thor, they're not walking around lifting up city gates and hauling them 40 miles away up to some mountaintop. You know, that's not part of the Arnold Classic competition going on here. So Samson is well known for this, but they just don't know, like, why? What's the source of his strength? So they come to her. They use the same words that we heard way back in chapter 14, verse 15, for entice or seduce, the same language the Philistines use when talking to Samson's fiance. Say so, entice him or seduce him and see where his great strength lies and how we may overpower him so that we may bind him to afflict him. And then, you know, to make matters a little bit more enticing for her, they said, here's what we'll do. We will basically make you a very, very rich woman, because they offer to give her, these are the lords of the Philistines. So five lords of the Philistines, one for each city. And they're each going to give her 1,100 pieces of silver. I mean, she would hit the jackpot.
Yeah.
So we'll...
I like the way the ESV translates this. You can tell me my Hebrew's not quite as good as Chad's. It uses this word. It says that we may overpower him, that we may bind him to humble him. And the reason I like that is, obviously, if you know what happens, is they very much go about the work of humbling. But it also fits very much with the Christologically, which happens. You know, you have the humbling of Christ.
Yeah, that's actually a very good translation. I mean, it's often used in sort of that way in the Psalms, for instance, to humble. I mean, it has this variety of meanings. I mean, it can mean, you know, to humble, to afflict, to put down, to make low, but it all has kind of that same kind of.
Yeah, I mean, they're not asking her to seduce him to find out where his strength is so we can kill him.
That's not their goal.
That's not the goal here.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, they're wanting the kind of revenge that you can't get simply by taking someone's life.
Right.
Yeah, they're wanting a complete humiliation of him. And then ironically, it turns out that they get exactly what they're wanting, right?
Right.
They do get him humiliated, but what they don't realize is that in doing that, they're going to place him in a position in which he's actually is going to use that humiliation to seek his revenge against them. But I'm getting ahead of the story. So that's kind of the deal. I mean, it's a terrible situation. I mean, it really is a tragedy when you have Samson in love with this woman, and you know, as has happened countless times throughout history, still happens today. All that ends up mattering to Delilah is how she can enrich herself off of this situation. So she starts the process of trying to find out what the secret of his strength is. You can see through each of these four episodes that she intensifies her feminine wiles, if you will. I mean, she's like trying every tactic that she can think of. She starts out with kind of a seemingly innocent question, I suppose. Please tell me where your strength is and how you may be bound to afflict you. You know, I'm just curious, right? Like, you know, if someone was wanting to bind you and to afflict you, how could they go about that? And Samson has at least the first three episodes. He has an answer to each of these, which of course is not the right answer. So he starts out by saying, if they bind me with seven fresh cords that have not been dried, well, then I'll become weak and be like any other man.
Yeah, you have to assume the first time he's not thinking that she's going to attempt this. So the first time is he's like, well, I'll just make something up. It's not like we're going to try it. And even if we did try it, I could fake it. You know, like he's not thinking probably what's going to happen is she's going to do this. And then there's going to be all these guys. I'm going to have a fight in my hand, you know? So, you know, if you're like, tell me this, and you're like, well, this is not something that we're ever going to do.
Yeah, I'm trying to get in the head of Samson in this situation is a bit of a challenge. I'm like, what is he like, detect any sinister motive here? Or does he think she's just playing? Or, you know, what's going on in his head, more or less?
Well, you could, after the first one, you could write off as you could think it's a fairly honest question.
Yeah.
You know, if you were out there doing all this crazy stuff and, you know, your wife says, how are you able to do that stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah. Reasonable question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
the first time.
Yeah. The first time. But after that, come on, man.
Yeah. 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 So they're going to try it. So the lords of the Philistines brought her these seven fresh cords that had not been dried. We have this recurring freshness, right? Mm-hmm. If we had the fresh jawbone, now we have seven fresh cords, which are probably like strips of leather that have not dried yet from some sort of animal hide, I'm guessing. Anyway, there's men that are already lying in wait. And she says, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he, as before, he snaps the cords as a string of tow snaps when it touches fire. And his strength was not discovered. So that wraps up the first episode. So what's going to happen with this, the second try of Delilah? So she says to Samson again, she's pushing a little bit harder this time. Look, you tricked me, right? You deceived me and told me lies.
That is rich.
That is rich. Yeah. Yeah, classic case of the pot calling the kettle black on that one. Like, how dare you lie to me?
You tricked me? Like, wait, what? What?
Yeah. How dare you act deceptively toward me when I'm so pure of heart?
Just crazy, man. That is nuts. Also, what we're going to find out is that apparently Samson's like really sound sleeper.
Yeah, he must be one of those guys like, you know, have the proverbial train go through the living room and he doesn't wake up. I've known a couple of guys like that. But she's pressing him, you know, you're mean. Why'd you lie to me? So he comes up with another reason or another way in which he supposedly can be weakened. So that is what you got to do. So you got to get new ropes, same Hebrew that was used when the men of Judah bound him. Get these new ropes, never been used. And if you bind me with those, then I'm gonna become weak and be like any other man. So what Delilah does, she takes these new ropes, she ties them up. Same thing, Philistines are upon you, Samson, because the men are lying in wait once more. And he snaps the ropes from his arms like a thread. Now, if he's not onto her by now, he's got some problems.
I mean,
but evidently he's not.
I mean, I guess what it doesn't say in these accounts, and that so she's crying out, she's doing it, and then crying out, the Philistines are upon you. I'm assuming that these Philistines are not upon him.
No,
right. So,
I'm assuming they're not.
Yeah, because I mean, no one's that dumb. So yeah. She's obviously playing this off as like, I did the thing, and then I scared you, and then I found out you were lying. So you shouldn't read it that you know the Philistines are rushing in and he kills a bunch of guys. She's like, oh, you lied to me. I can't believe it. Like she wants to know. At least the first two, it seems that like he's tying up and then he breaks it. So they have not rushed in yet.
Yeah. 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 She's testing the waters to see how honest he's being. And of course these first two times, nothing whatsoever to do with his hair, right? This is all just being tied up. So fresh cords or new ropes. Now it's going to get a little closer to home when we get into the third try. She says, verse 13, up to now you have deceived me and told me lies. And to tell me how you are bound. So she's just trying the same tactic once more, accusing him of deception and lies. Now he gets a little closer, and this is it's kind of a strange description here. And this is also one of those cases where the Hebrews messed up, and the translators have taken some words from the Septuagint to kind of fill this in. So my translation has, he replies, if you weave the seven locks of my hair with a web and fasten it with a pin, then I shall be weak and be like any other man. So he falls asleep. Delilah takes the seven locks of his hair, weaves them into the web, fastens it with a pin, says the same thing. He wakes up, pulls the pin out, and he's just as strong as ever. So I don't really know exactly what this looked like. This, you know, she's weaving his hair anyway, fastening it in some way, but I think the important point is that he's getting a little closer. He's got a lot closer, actually, to revealing the source of his strength, because he's no longer talking about, you know, being tied up by different kinds of cords or ropes. But now he's actually moved to his head. He's talking about his hair now.
Yeah, it kind of seems like that there was a horrible movie made about Samson a few years ago. But the one thing that it seemed like they maybe got right was that the guy they had play Samson had like these huge dreadlock type things, and it kind of seems like that's the case, right? Like what does this mean, the you know, that he has the seven locks of his hair? So you assume that maybe that's what it is. So he's got these seven, you know, huge dreadlocks or something. Right. Which is kind of like intimidating, right?
Yeah, especially considering that he's never cut his hair. As you can imagine how long it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that could have been what's happening, but he's getting closer and closer to revealing the truth to her. So we find out the truth beginning in episode 4 of this kind of back and forth between Samson and Delilah, beginning at verse 15. So now she's like, she's pulling out the full artillery, emotional artillery against him. She says to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have deceived me these three times and have not told me where your great strength is. And then verse 16, you got to love verse 16. And it came about when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him that his soul was annoyed to death. It's got to be one of the humorous verses in the Bible. You just kind of picture, I mean, he's kind of become the they're not married, but like the henpecked husband, you know. She just won't let up, just constant barrage. Why aren't you telling me? Why are you so mean? You don't really love me. Why don't you tell me your strength? Over and over and over until he's just become so annoyed that he'd rather die than go on listening to listening to her. So he finally gives in. Verse 17, he spills the beans. He told her all that was in his heart, and he said, "This is what my strength is. A razor has never come on my head because I've been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaved, then my strength will leave me and I shall become weak and be like any other man." So, you know, Samson had, he had broken his Nazarite vows in other ways. He had touched that which was dead. He presumably was drinking at his wedding feast. That's what they did, a Philistine wedding feast. But he had not cut his hair. That's like the one part of his life where he had remained faithful to his Nazarite vows. And Delilah can evidently tell what's going on here. It says that she saw that he had told her all that was in his heart. So she arranges everything, right? She calls for the lords of the Philistines and says, "All right, one more time. Now he's told me all that it's in his heart." So the Philistine lords, they come up to her and they come with a credit card in hand, right? Or cash in hand, I should say. They bring all this sack loads of money to her, all this silver that they'd promised to her. And she made him sleep on her knees. I guess he falls asleep with his head on her lap, more or less. And then she calls for the barber, the Philistine barber, and he comes in and he shaves off the 7 locks. Yeah, he must have been I don't think I could get a haircut without waking up. I mean, I would have to be like out cold not to wake up when somebody's cutting my hair. But that's what happens. It shaves it off. And then it says, this is, I don't know, this might be in some ways like the lowest point of this story. She began to afflict him and his strength left him. I mean, it was bad enough that she lied to him, used him, and betrayed him. And now she's just like hurting him, afflicting him, just to see what happens. And his strength left him. So she says, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And he wakes up and he thinks, "Ah, you know, same song, second verse, third verse, fourth verse. I do what I've always done. I'm going to go out and I'll shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. So just kind of wrap up this little section with verse 21. The Philistines seized him. And as was relatively common back in that culture, when you had captured an enemy, you mutilated him in some way, either by, we've seen it earlier in Judges about chopping off fingers or toes. In this case, they gouge out his eyes and they bring him down to Gaza. They bound him in bronze chains and he was a grinder in the prison. So he's blind, he's bound, and he's exiled and he's made to do servile work. So you can't help but see this as, yeah, a tragic end to Samson, but in some ways, just something he's almost prepared himself. He's almost like paved the way for all this to happen, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's where we see him at this point.
Yeah, I mean, all of this is really interesting if you're looking at Samson as this type of Christ. I mean, and I think this is why we talked about it last episode. Why the fact that it says that he loved Delilah is important, because it's a real betrayal, and you know, if you're thinking about people being betrayed by people they love for silver, well, you the first Samson's not the first thing that comes to mind. The first thing that comes to mind is Christ being betrayed by someone that he loves for silver. In fact, if you take, you know, denials or betrayals of Peter, and then you have the denial of or the betrayal of Judas, you end up with 4, which is the exact same amount of times that Samson is betrayed by the one that he loves. And then what does this betrayal result in? Well, it results in his humbling, which is why that word is interesting, that they do humble him, and they gouge out his eyes, and they bind him, they're mocking him. And not only that, but then where they make him do that, it's if the gates of Gaza are symbolic for the gates of hell, well, this is exactly where they go and stick him. Yeah, so they, great. So he is literally, they've literally now, he's been betrayed for silver. He's been captured. He's been beaten and ridiculed. He's been humbled. And then he is now grinding at the mill in hell, essentially. And that would be that there's a lot of Christ-like things going on there. And it wouldn't be a full Christ-like picture if you didn't have this but,
right,
which is the next verse, right? Which is, yeah, all this is happening. First. You're like, this is tragic. This is a horrible end. You have this guy betrayed by the person he loves for silver, and now he's being humbled, and he's down in hell. What's going to happen here? And you have, but the hair of his head began to grow after it had been shaved. This is like the gospel coming in or something at this point. This is like but God thing, which, by the way, also, how stupid do you have to be to not make sure the hair of this guy's head does not grow?
I'd have the Philistine barber in there 3 times a week shaving Samson's head.
Yeah.
No hair on your head, buddy.
Yeah. But yeah, when I read this, I think of Christ down in hell, and there's a but there, that he's certainly, this is not the end. Now there's so much stuff that happens to Samson that foreshadows what happens to the ultimate deliverer of Israel, which is Christ, of course. But you have to go all the way back and hear the words of Christ to his mother that he will begin, right? He will begin to save Israel.
Yeah. Same Hebrew word, by the way. Yeah. I was just looking at that this morning. Same Hebrew word. He'll begin to save Israel. The Spirit began to stir him to action. And here we have the hair in his head began to grow again.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think this particular verse, verse 22, about the hair of his head began to grow again after it was shaved off, I think that is like, that is the literary masterpiece in the book of Judges.
Yeah.
Because it just, it just kind of drops it in there, but it's such a beautiful foreshadowing of what's to come. It's like a big wink right there in the middle of the story. Oh, by the way, his hair began to grow again. And it just kind of drops it right there. Right. And it never even returns to it again. It just kind of, it's like a pregnant expression, just kind of leaves you expecting something to happen.
Yeah, you're like, well, if it gets long again, does that mean that the Lord comes back to him, or once he shaved it, is it just done? Which is also an interesting point. Is Samson beyond the point of no return? The answer to that question is no.
Yeah, absolutely not. Yeah. I don't know about you. This is kind of a side note, but since you brought it up, I don't know about you, but I get communication from people on a pretty regular basis who are concerned that they are outside the pale of the faith, mm-hmm. Because they're in a kind of a Samson-like situation. Man, I've done this, or I was in rebellion against God for this long. I did these things, and they're struggling with wondering, is God basically washed his hands of me? Is there any room for me anymore in the kingdom of God, or more or less, have I outsinned God's grace?
Yeah.
And of course the answer is always and emphatically, absolutely not.
Yeah. Or maybe, because, yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe you even think, well, maybe I could be forgiven, but God would never use me.
Yes, that too.
Yeah. And we find out this is not the case either.
No. Yeah. I mean, he might take me back, but he'll make me like the lowest servant, mm-hmm. something like that. And that's not the way the grace of God works. He forgives and forgets. And I mean, he is the God who throws a party when prodigals return.
Yeah.
He doesn't sit there and chastise them and give them, a chance maybe to prove their sincerity. No, he runs out to meet them, embraces them, and throws a party to rejoice at their return. And I think that's what's going on here with Samson.
Yeah, I mean,
we might not see a party, but it really is a it's a rejoicing on the part of God what's going to happen.
Yeah, and at the very least, I mean, in the Old Testament narrative, which just foreshadows the gospel over and over and over and over again, right? He's constantly letting the role of his son be played by actors like Samson. It's always like that. The role of Christ is always played by someone who just is, like, I mean, a total sinner, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Quite fittingly, because Christ ends up being the greatest of sinners.
Yes.
Yeah, he becomes the, as Luther says in his commentary on Galatians, that Christ has become the murderer, he's become the adulterer, he's become the idolater, he's become all of this, because it's no longer our sin that's on us, but our sin is completely on Christ. Mm-hmm. So he becomes the one who becomes that sin. And that's why you look at some of the Psalms that are obviously about the Messiah, like Jesus will quote these Psalms himself as referring to himself, and these same Psalms contain confessions of sin. Mm-hmm. Well, how's that? Well, because Christ took that sin upon himself. He who knew no sin became sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God.
Yeah, I mean, you even see this part that looks a lot like Christ, where it says that the Lord left him.
Yes.
And this sounds very much like, my God, why have you forsaken me, right? That,
yeah.
That God has left him and let him be taken, you know, he's been delivered into the hands of his enemies.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but he's there and his enemies are rejoicing, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the hordes of hell thinking that they've won the day at the crucifixion of Christ. But they are going to be wrong. After the recording of his hair began to grow again, it says that they decided they were going to have a party of their own, right? Lords of the Philistines, they assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. Now, we're going to meet Dagon a little bit later on after we get out of Judges, because this will be the god in whose temple the Philistines placed the Ark of the Covenant.
Great story.
After they captured it. Yeah, yeah. One of the best stories of scripture. They go in the morning, and first of all, the idol has fallen on his face. So it's almost like he's worshiping Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And then they go back in the next day, and his hands are cut off, and he's been decapitated. So that's what happens. That's what happens when you put the Ark of the Covenant inside a temple of Dagon. But I love the way that it ends the way it does. It doesn't end, this final episode in Samson's life doesn't end with him like at maybe the king's palace or the Lord's palace or something like that, or in some open square or something like that. I mean, this is a religious festival, a religious party, and quite appropriately, because what's about to happen is the ultimate of contest. Just like we saw Yahweh attacking the gods of the Egyptians in the Exodus, this is going to be Yahweh through another Moses, through Samson, attacking the gods of the Philistines. And they're rejoicing. So they're going to offer this great sacrifice to Dagon in rejoicing and in thanksgiving for the fact that, as they say, our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hands. So they're attributing their success not to, you know, their sneaky endeavors with Delilah. They're actually attributing success, their success, to the work of their God. This is the kind of theological reasoning that would have been pervasive in the ancient world. They attributed all the good stuff, all the bad stuff to their God. So they're attributing this victory over Samson to their God, Dagon. And then it's not just the rulers, but the people saw him. They praised their God. They said, our God has given our enemy into our hands, even the destroyer of our country who has slain many of us. So this is like almost a kind of a national religious festival, you could say, in which they're gathered together to give thanks to the God Dagon for delivering this greatest of their enemies into their hands. And then verse 25, they're in high spirits. So their heart was good, but I suspect we know the Philistines like to drink beer.
I was about to say, this says when their hearts were merry. I'm like, it sounds like it says when they had a couple too many, they come up with this great idea.
I don't know if I mentioned earlier, but archaeologists have found, because there's been a lot of archaeological digging at the Pentapolis cities, and they have found these beer canisters with like a little filter on the end of them to, you know, capture any of the stuff that you don't want to drink. So the Philistines were big into beer. So I can just kind of get this picture. It's a religious festival, but it's also a drinking festival, and everybody's happy and they're getting wasted. And they call for Samson from the prison. They say, call for Samson that he may amuse us. Literally, it's make us laugh. It's the same root from Isaac, Yitzhak, to make us laugh. And they call for him from prison, and they make him stand between these two pillars. Well, what's going to happen? Well, Samson addresses the young man who, I guess, brought him from the prison. And he says, let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them. I mean, I love the way the story is told, because, I mean, if you didn't know the story, it's kind of, you know, speeding up and slowing down, making you think, oh, what's going on here? You know, why does he want to feel the pillars? What's going on here? Then we have this this interlude, this one verse that kind of paints the scene for us. It says the house was full. Men, women, all the leaders of the Philistines were there. There's like 3,000 men and women on the roof looking down while Samson was amusing them. Now, I got to point out a little bit of a Hebrew wordplay here. It's a little bit hard to describe without actually seeing it, but the word that's translated as amused is sahak. But in the original Hebrew, it could either be pronounced sahak or shahak. And it's not clear either one. Now, if you pronounce it as sahak, it means to amuse. But if you pronounce it as shahak, it means to crush. So I think there's sort of a double entendre, in other words, that's going on here. So Samson, was Samson amusing them, or was Samson about to crush them? Well, the answer is yes. And it's at this point that we now hear Samson's second recorded prayer. He calls on God and says, oh, Lord, please remember me.
Let's go. Please. Let's go with remember me.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's go. Right. Let's go.
There you go. Zakar me, right? Good, please remember me.
It's a good prayer to pray no matter who you are, man.
Very good prayer. Yeah. And strengthen me just this one time, oh God, that I may be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. Let's go ahead and finish it out, then we'll talk about it. So Samson grasps the two middle pillars on which the house rested, and he braced himself against them, the one with his right hand and the other with his left. And Samson utters then finally his dying words, his last words were, let me die with the Philistines. Bends with all his might. The house fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he killed in his life. And then it wraps up by saying that after this, his brothers and all his father's household came, took him, brought his body up from there and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of his father, Manoah. Thus he had judged Israel 20 years. Now that is some rich storytelling.
Yeah. And there's so many things to point to, right? I mean,
it's like, where do you start? Christ is written all over this.
All over it, man. I mean, the fact that he would he would literally die like with his arms stretched out.
Yeah. Right.
And in doing so, I mean this line, like, in his death he killed, like, this is exactly what happens with Christ, that in his death he defeats everyone. All the enemies of God are destroyed in his death. And again, this is why Samson begins to save Israel. But man, it's quite the beginning. And Christ will have a similar death, mocked, ridiculed, spat upon, entertainment. And yet in his death, he will destroy all the enemies. And in that case, we're not talking about people. We're talking about sin, death, the devil, hell, all of it being destroyed. So it's pretty remarkable.
This is like the Gospel of Judges, right?
Yeah.
This is one of those stories that if you have Christ before your eyes when you're reading the Old Testament, you cannot read the 16th chapter of Judges without seeing basically the humiliation and crucifixion and resurrection of Christ just all over this story.
I mean, it's, I mean, even the, I mean, obviously this is like a pagan sort of event, but even sort of Christ talking about destroying the temple and, you know, all of this, I mean, this is mm-hmm. all happening here, right? I mean, so this, you assume this is some sort of temple-like thing going on here, right? There's yeah. This big sacrifice and stuff. He's ending that. I mean, the way that these stories work too, there's things just weaved in there. I mean, the remember me, while Samson, of course, is the sort of Christ figure in this story, he's also this horrible sinner. And as we know, horrible sinners sometimes, especially when they're crucified next to Christ, will say words like remember me.
So he's a figure of Christ and a figure of the thief at the same time.
He's got pillars on each side of him, for sure. But he sort of gets to play the role of Christ, but then he obviously is someone who needs to be redeemed and remembered by God.
This is one of those stories where when you're reading it alongside Christ's story, you realize that really they're one and the same. Mm-hmm. And that by the time you get to reading the Gospels, you've already read the Gospels. In other words, you've read them in a different sort of way. You've read about the Exodus. You've read about stories like Samson. You've read about David. You've read the writings of Isaiah. So in many ways, you've read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John before you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It just so happens that what you're reading, what you did read in black and white, you're now seeing in full color in the Gospels of Christ. But it's all there, just in a Old Testament sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, it's so all there that you're almost shocked that, you know, there's not some place in the New Testament where Paul says, just as Samson, whatever, you know?
Right.
It's so there. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, when Christ says, all the scriptures testify of me, like Samson's one of the ones where you're like, I believe you.
Yeah. On the road to Emmaus, Christ surely visited the story of Samson when he was talking with Cleopas and his companion. This is one of those Emmaus road kind of experiences. You know, you read this and your heart is burning within you because you realize, oh, wow, yeah, this is about Christ. This is a portrayal beforehand of the work that he would do in his sacrificial death, in which by death he would destroy the power of death.
I one time listened to this horrible sermon about how to not choose women the way Samson does, and how he just has like the worst taste in women, right? Which, and the reason that was so horrible is that essentially what that sermon is about, this guy didn't know this, but what it was about is don't choose a bride like God does. Because this is what he does, right? I mean, so he's like, don't choose a woman who will betray you. I'm like, well, God does.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great example of what a non-Christological approach to the scriptures will yield you, right? You're looking for something in the Bible that the Bible is not concerned about whatsoever. This is not dating 101.
No.
That's what Samson's story is all about.
No, you don't look at God. The only thing you could look at the way that God interacts with his people is to say, here's how you love your sinful spouse.
Yes.
But if you were going to God and saying, I bet you I could go to God and figure out exactly the kind of person to choose. It's like, well, God chooses the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to be marrying Gomer, right?
That's exactly right.
You're going to be another Hosea.
That's exactly right. Well, all right, well, man.
We finished out Samson. Yeah, we're going to enter into the final section of Judges next time, beginning with chapter 17, in which we are not finished with some crazy stories and some pretty dark stories that are coming up as well. So stay tuned.
All right. Well, guys, we will see you next week.